Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lindsay Addario, whose book is titled It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. This book is her memoir about what it's like to be a photographer in very, very dangerous places. You still do freelance work for the New York Times.
I work primarily as a freelance photographer for the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time Magazine.
At the end of the book, you talk about finally getting into National Geographic. Why is that considered the creme de la creme?
Well, actually, it was obviously a great honor to start working with National Geographic, but for me, also, the New York Times and Time are great to work for because I think the type of work that I do has to do with foreign policy, international affairs, and so for me, it is equally as important to work with the New York Times and Time because I want the readership to vary. And so I started working with National Geographic in 2006 and did my first story for them in 2007. And I always try and do one big piece for them a year, but I also, when I'm not working with them, I work with the New York Times mostly.
The New York Times, of course, is more immediate because you'll be getting your pictures in maybe within a day or two or a week or two. So it's a kind of different work, isn't
it? Very different, very different. In fact, a story for National Geographic could take a year or two to publish. In fact, I have a story coming out in April 2015, and I started working on that before I got pregnant in 2011.
Where is that? Is that Darfur?
It's India. In India, and it took 3 years. So it depends. I mean, for me, I also enjoy the immediacy of the New York Times, and I enjoy being able to really dig into a story at National Geographic. So they're very different.
This particular book, Lindsay Addario, this particular book is your memoir. Had you done much writing before this?
I kept journals for a long time, and especially when I first started out, when I first started photographing, and I didn't have very many assignments, so I had a lot of time to write. And in order to do this book, I went back to correspondence as well. So I went back to the journals, I went back to handwritten letters that I had written friends, and I went back to emails, and I sort of downloaded everything, sat with them, and I also looked at my outtakes of photographs. So not only would I look at my selection of images from, say, Afghanistan in 2007, but I would look at the entire take. And for me, it really brings me back to what I was thinking at that time.
And you were able to go into detail about very specific events such as your time with the Taliban, your capture in Libya, and there was another capture. Where was that?
Iraq.
Or in Iraq, yeah.
Well, after I was captured in Iraq with a colleague for the New York Times, I actually was asked to write a piece. And so I started writing that the week after we were released. And so it was very fresh in my mind. And so luckily, in that instance, I had that piece to work off of. In Libya, I was held hostage with Anthony Shadid, Steve Farrell, and Tyler Hicks. And the minute we crossed into Tunisia when we were released, we had promised ourselves and promised each other that we would write a transcript, literally download our brains of everything that happened to us, every single memory we had from captivity. And we created literally a transcript of our captivity that we all four worked on. And so I used that, and that provided great detail. And then I sent those chapters to Tyler Hicks and Steve Farrell and asked them to look it over and make sure that everything seemed right with them and accurate and factually correct.
Did you talk to your exes about those segments?
Well, I told one of my exes, I told him I was writing a book, and he said, basically, be gentle. And I said, no, because I felt like it was important to be honest. And, you know, it's putting myself out there. It's putting him out there. But these are things that happen. And I'm, at the end of the day, I'm a journalist. And if I'm going to write something, I have to be honest about it and expose myself because I have spent my entire life interviewing people about their most intimate moments. And so if I'm going to take this on, I've got to be honest as well.
Do you think that doing the photographer's work made it easier for you to keep the self-censor at bay?
I don't know. I think just being a journalist made it easier to sort of just sift through everything that I had gone through. I mean, some names were changed in the book. I did change some names.
To protect them, I would guess.
Yeah, and protect myself, too.
you know, to put yourself sometimes in a bad light can be very difficult to write about.
It's clear I made some pretty bad decisions at certain points, but I talk about them because I think it's important that people are honest and people, I discuss very candidly my ambivalence to get pregnant. And when I found out I was pregnant and how tortured I was so scared. I thought my life would end. I thought my career would end. And I think, of course, I'm getting criticism for that. But for me, I want to be honest. And in fact, I'm getting tons of emails from women saying, God, thank you for finally talking about this because no one talks about it.
Lindsay Addario, you grew up in, you know, a fairly normal environment, and yet at the same time, your dad eventually came out as gay. Do you think living in an environment where even before he came out, you had to be open, meet gay people, meet different kinds of people, that this opened you up to the possibility of being less judgmental when you actually did your photography?
Oh, definitely. There's no question. I mean, I think that from the time I can remember, my parents always had a very open house and always taught us to not be judgmental of people, especially people who would be considered living on the margins or people who were different. And I think even before my father came out, there were always gay people, transvestites, whoever walked in the house. It didn't matter. For us, it was really about accepting people and just fostering a household where people loved each other and it was fun and we had a good time and we always just enjoyed each other's presence. And I think so that I took with me and that I carry with me every day as a journalist.
And also it meant that you were always subjected to interesting things to look at, I would think.
I mean, as a child, I didn't realize they were interesting. To me, it was just what I knew, and it was just how I grew up. So it never was something that was unique to me. It was only when I became an adult and people said, oh, your father came out of the closet? And I'd say, yeah, and he's still with Bruce, and they've been together 30 years. And I don't think twice, because for me, that's just how it was, and that was part of our life. And, you know, I sort of have lived with this and lived with great sisters who also have an incredible attitude and parents.
It becomes clear as we're reading It's What I Do that you see the distinction between things that you've been told and what actually exists. And I wonder if that goes back to those days, seeing the discrepancy between how society viewed a household like yours and, you know, what was actually going on.
Well, it's funny because I have friends whose parents would not let them come over. And they said, oh, that's the house where people do drugs, or that's the house with no rules. And honestly, I grew up in Westport, Connecticut, and we are pretty much the only family where everyone is incredibly happy, successful, and very well adjusted. And I think there's something to be said for allowing your children to experiment, but in an environment of love and support. And so often it was sort of the topic of conversation at the PTA, the Parent Teacher Association, and they'd say, oh, the Addario house, and sort of roll their eyes. But actually, what was really going on was just sort of this open house where people were having a good time.
Getting to the non-judgmental part, your photographs are non-judgmental, and that has to come from somewhere.
I hope they are. I mean, I think that I consider it a privilege and an honor to go into people's lives, and I would hope I wouldn't go in there with all sorts of prejudices and go in there to sort of take my subject down. I just want to go in with my eyes open and let them tell the story. I mean, and really let them tell the story with images and with their words.
Let's get into some of the details of It's What I Do, Lindsay Addario. You spent time in Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, well, Gaza, Syria. You lived in Turkey. When you look at what we see in the news, how often are you seeing discrepancies? How often should we be believing what we see?
It's hard because I haven't lived in the U.S. in 15 years, so I actually don't see what you see very often. For me, I go and live in the reality, and I go and I photograph and I send my pictures. I see what's published of mine, not the hard copy. I often just get a list of what's been published, and I move on. But when I come home for things like the book tour or when I come home home for right. Christmas, or, and I watch the news, it's always so shocking to me because it seems so sensational, particularly TV journalism. I think that the written journalism, and I read the New York Times, and I think it's still quality, and I think it's still quite unbiased. But when I look at the TV, there's always some catchphrase, or it's always some, you know, the war with this, or the war with that, or, you know, and the war on terror, and everything is so sort of inaccessible. I think if I were a viewer in the U.S., I would have no idea how to get my head around these topics. And I think what the job of a journalist and the job of a photographer is to make these stories accessible and to do them in an intimate way so that people back home have an entry point and they have a place to say, okay, this is a story about one family. This is a story about how a family lives their life in, you know, in close proximity to ISIS or something. And so that's what's surprising to me, is that I never feel like I have an entry point for the news when I'm watching TV here.
Speaking of how people, individuals, are very different, this sequence when you go to interview people in the Taliban or to take pictures, and you know damn well that they do not allow photographs, well, they do, and the people are going, yeah, sure, take photos, which is completely counter to what we hear.
Yeah, and I think one of the great lessons I've learned over the years is that nothing is what it seems from the outside. And I always have this vision of how a place is going to be, and it will be this terrifying, horrible place. And when I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban, I couldn't believe how incredible the people were. They were so hospitable. They were so lovely. Everyone invited me into their homes. They were dirt poor. I mean, this is in 2000. And people were hanging out their windows trying to invite me in for lunch because it was hospitality, basic hospitality in South Asia and in Afghanistan. And to me, it was so shocking because I thought, oh boy, life under the Taliban it'll be, you know, the worst thing on the planet. But actually, I met the loveliest people. And so that's part of my job, to discuss those things and to get them out there, that in fact, things are not always what they seem.
This becomes very, very clear, Lindsay Addario. It becomes very clear when we're talking about the invasion and the occupation of Iraq. Obviously, there was the ginning up to the war, which you perceived, you must have seen somewhere. I mean, at that time, what were you thinking?
Well, I was pretty young at that point. I hadn't really covered a war from start to finish. And I knew that I wanted to be there because it was very clear our government was sort of gearing up to send troops. And we knew what the goal was for Saddam Hussein to fall and to find these weapons of mass destruction. I think the press corps in general was pretty skeptical about why we were going into Iraq.
The press corps was, but the pundits were not. I mean, what we got here was that
sure,
they all were ginning up for war.
There were some journalists who sort of drank the Kool-Aid and just published and talked about whatever they were fed from politicians and people who wanted support of the war. The rest of us sort of were skeptical, but we didn't know. I mean, that was the reason why we had to go in there, because we had to see firsthand what exactly was happening. It was a very interesting time. I didn't really know what to expect. I knew I wanted to be there, and I sort of followed my colleagues and took their lead on how to cover Iraq.
Do you think that embedding all of those journalists in some way subverted their perspectives?
Not everyone was embedded. I mean, in fact, journalists have three choices. You could go embedded with the military. You can go make your way unilaterally, rent a car and drive up literally from Kuwait into Baghdad. Or you can go from the north, which I chose to do, which we at that point thought the fourth ID was going to travel from Turkey into Iraq and we would sort of follow behind them. Or there would be a humanitarian crisis and that Iraqis would flee from southern Iraq into the north.
Right.
But none of that happened because Turkey didn't allow the American troops to go through their border. So, in fact, we sat in northern Iraq covering almost a proxy war while the U.S. was raining cruise missiles on Al-Ansar, which was a fundamentalist group in northern Iraq at the time. And then when Saddam fell, we made our way down towards Kirkuk and Tikrit and Mosul. But really, we sort of watched the fall of Baghdad on TV.
One thing about the invasion of Iraq Cheney would say, they'll throw flowers at the troops and it'll be wonderful. And the perspective I got in reading It's What I Do is that on some level, the first days, he was right.
He was right. And it depended where you were as a journalist. I mean, I was coming from the North. Kurds have always been supportive of Americans. But I remember driving from Sulaymaniyah to Kirkuk, and literally soldiers were pulled out of their Humvees and kissed. I mean, Iraqis were kissing them, throwing flowers at them. People were euphoric. But that really only lasted a few days, maybe a few weeks. It didn't last because very quickly the country fell apart and there was looting everywhere. There was no electricity. The water was in short supply. People had to line up for days to get money out of the bank. I mean, there was no plan for the aftermath. And of course, the worst thing that happened is that Bremer, who had been in charge of the, of basically running the country, he had been appointed to sort of start the government there, and he disbanded the entire Iraqi army, which created a militia of Sunni militants who hated, they were Ba'athists, and he just disbanded them. I mean, it's the worst thing you can do. Instead of incorporate them, use them on our side, and actually have people happy with jobs and who were trained in the military, he fired everyone.
Did you read Imperial Life in the Emerald City?
No, but I know Rajiv.
You know, there was the green zone, and then there was outside the green zone, and then in the green zone you had all of these kids coming in trying to tell Iraqis how to run their own country. How much of that did you actually see?
We saw a lot of that, actually. We used to joke around as journalists because it was almost like they lived on Venus, I mean, in the green zone. I mean, it was like America had been transplanted to Baghdad, and they had, you know, a swimming pool and barbecues, and everything was sort of safe there. And journalists lived in the red zone, you know. I mean, we lived with Iraqis, and we lived in Baghdad. And I remember one day I had gone, I had just finished a military embed, and we landed in the green zone, in the landing zone, and we were about to leave, and our Iraqi driver was picking us up at the entrance, and these soldiers looked at my colleague and I, and they were like, "You're going into the red zone?" And we said, "Yeah, actually, we live in the red zone." So it was always sort of, there were, you know, the green zone and the red zone, but journalists generally, we all lived in Baghdad.
And how about after things began to really fall apart?
At that point, I stopped going because I was there 2003, 2004, early 2005. And then I felt like as a photographer, my access was so limited that I actually couldn't contribute that much to coverage because so much of our day was spent locked in our bureaus. And writers can actually do reporting by making phone calls, going to see people, whatever. But for a photographer, it was so limited what you could do. And I said, I'd rather focus elsewhere. And then I started going back to Afghanistan and Darfur.
And, of course, at that point, it became less and less safe to even travel in Iraq.
Generally, security is what dictates how much we can work. But it was also the fact that if I'm going to take a risk, I want to be able to take photographs. And, you know, it's one thing taking a risk just to be there. But if I couldn't pull my camera out pretty much any time, then there's no point in taking that risk.
It sounds as if over that period of time, the GIs began to also turn against the journalists.
Access became a little harder. But I didn't actually have that experience. The last time I was there was in January of 2005, and I went back again 6 years or 5 years later to do a story for National Geographic. But I didn't have that experience, really, about being shut out by the military.
How realistic were the people there in terms of the politics? I mean, were they Republicans, Democrats? What do they think of Obama?
First of all, people didn't really talk like that. I mean, that was something that no one really talked openly about. They wouldn't really speak on the record in front of journalists. And so I think it was a cumbersome process and a lengthy process to arrange a military embed. But certainly if you did the paperwork, you could do embeds. I think it was just a matter of doing your homework and putting your time in and getting access. But troops didn't talk politics in front of journalists.
It seems like the scariest thing was when you got in a car and you didn't want it to break down.
anywhere. I mean, in fact, I'd say probably meeting the Taliban was the day I really didn't want it to break down. But I mean, I think in any war zone, you don't want to be in a car that breaks down.
Lindsay Addario, what is it about a war zone that attracts you? I mean, do you get excited by being in the center of that?
I get excited about being on the front lines of history. I get excited about being able to witness and document what's happening as it unfolds, especially if I'm on assignment for the New York Times, a publication that I know people in positions of power will read those stories and they'll see the pictures, and maybe I have the ability to influence the decisions they make.
Well, you hope.
I hope. I mean, I can't,
level, yeah.
You know, say, you know, some presidents, I wasn't very sure if they read the New York Times, but, you know, I hope President Obama does.
Physical descriptions, I mean, we don't really see that much. But northern Iraq is green and gorgeous?
It depends. In the north, there are times of the year where it's beautiful and lush.
And the desert?
Monochromatic.
Does that make it harder for you to take photos?
Incredibly hard. I mean, I remember in August of 2004 when I was leaving Iraq, or July, it was sort of summer 2004, and I just thought, I cannot look at beige anymore, and I cannot photograph in this light. I mean, the light is so harsh, and obviously for any photographer, we relish in that golden light, but in the Middle East in the summer, it is incredibly harsh.
And Darfur is the same, I guess.
Well, actually, no, because Darfur is Africa. And so you get these beautiful spells of gorgeous morning and evening light.
But not in Iraq.
No. They last for about a half hour or 45 minutes in the summer. And the palette is different. I mean, in Sudan or in Africa, you get colors, and the women are dressed in these brilliant colors. And everything around you just has a richness that I had a very hard time finding in Iraq.
When you're taking photos and you're a professional photographer, do you have issues with copyright and the internet?
I think at this stage, not as much. Well, I'm sure my pictures are stolen around the world and people download them and make prints or whatever. But in terms of if my images were to be reprinted in a publication without my credit, people would see it because the images are generally originally published in a publication that's recognizable. For example, last year, one day I was in New York and I got an email from someone saying, your photograph of refugees fleeing from Syria into northern Iraq has just been stolen. And AFP, which is Agence France-Presse, is syndicating your image with the byline of an Iraqi photographer. And I was told within minutes of it going on the wire. And I wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have paid attention. But it was another editor who had access to the wire. And so I emailed someone at AFP and said, what is going on? And immediately they sort of were doing damage control and trying to figure out. And to me, this is the digital world, that a photographer in Iraq can take one of my images, download it on the internet, put his name on it, and refile it to an agency. Of course, the photographer in Iraq has blame, but I think it's more the responsibility of AFP. How can you not recognize this picture? And how dare you accept such a low-resolution image that it's completely pixelated and not ask the photographer to send a high-res? So to me, it's like there were a series of errors made, and agencies need to be much more responsible about who they buy images from.
Use of color versus black and white photography.
When I first started out, I saw things in black and white, and now I see in color. It is very seldom I will shoot a story and say, you know what, this is a black and white story. And I did with the Talibanistan piece that was published in the New York Times Magazine in 2008. But overall, I haven't shot black and white in years. I'm just a color photographer.
Digital versus
film.
Analog film.
I shoot digital. I shot a film. I started with film. I learned in the darkroom, and I made the transition to digital after September 11th, like so many photographers. And now the quality of digital cameras is so good, I stick with digital.
Manipulation of images.
Not okay. I think people rely so heavily on post-production. It's a crime because if you wait long enough and if you wait for the right light and if you do your homework as a photographer, you can get that beautiful image. You don't have to actually manipulate it.
Can you tell if a photo's been manipulated?
I'm not very good at Photoshop. I've never been trained in it, so I can't really tell, but I can tell when it's really been manipulated. I mean, the World Press Organization, they have arguably one of the biggest contests for photojournalism in the world. They will ask the photographers to submit the raw files because they were getting so many manipulated images. And that's a real tragedy because if photographers are winning on the basis of the post-production they're doing, what does it say for the actual photo?
So all of the photos that you have in It's What I Do, none of them have been manipulated.
Not manipulated. They've been exactly what happens in the darkroom. I can lighten, darken, dodge, burn, and crop.
How about saturation?
Yeah, add a little. If you look at my pictures, nothing looks sort of crazy dramatic. And I think if it does, it's because I woke up at 4 a.m. So I really try to make pictures look as accurate as they were the day I shot them.
It's as if these pictures were taken with film and you'll do kind of tweaking.
Tweaking, like color correction, for example.
Right.
Sometimes when you shoot digital, the image comes up on the screen as more magenta than I remembered it. So I'll try and correct that. It's lighter or darker, stuff like that. So I think that, of course, I think almost every photographer does that.
When you're looking at the photos afterward, are you ever really surprised at what you captured or failed to capture?
Yeah. First of all, I'm always tormented at what I failed to capture. So I always think I've missed the image. But sometimes I'm shooting so fast and a situation is changing so fast that I don't know if I got it. And so sometimes I'll look at my camera and see that I took an image that is dramatic and I didn't actually remember taking exactly that image.
Lindsay Addario, does understanding a particular foreign culture or language help simply in taking a picture?
I think so. I personally think that in order to be a good photographer, you have to get to know the people you're photographing. But some people would argue differently.
Why do you think you have to?
I don't think you have to. I just think it makes your pictures more intimate, better, deeper. For me, I want to know what makes a person tick before I photograph them. I want to make them feel comfortable. I would like to sit and talk to them and really just let them let their guard down a little bit.
Well, it also means that after a time, they're going to let you take your picture.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that. Sometimes women in Afghanistan don't ever agree. I mean, it just depends.
Being a woman in a war zone, in a sense, when you were in the Middle East, it kind of protected you a little bit?
I think so. I think that one of the reasons I'm alive is because I'm a woman. Maybe in Iraq, the first time we were kidnapped, the presence of a woman sort of threw them for a loop. Initially, they went to take just my colleague from the car, and I jumped out after him and said, hey, it's my husband, because I thought if they take a man alone, they'll kill him, especially an American man in the heart of the insurgency outside of Fallujah. And they kind of were confused by the presence of a woman. And I think even though I've been kidnapped and punched in the face and tied up, I think I'm alive because I'm a woman.
The only incidents that I can find in the book where potential rape happened was in Libya.
Correct. And I was groped repeatedly by Gaddafi soldiers, and I don't know who, because I was blindfolded most of the time.
What about with American soldiers? Did you have any issues?
Never.
Never?
Never. No.
When you were talking to female soldiers, did they ever tell you about their issues?
No, but I know their issues. But I wasn't doing that story at the time. So I have several colleagues who have focused on that story now, and they have done incredible work. It's a very important story. But when I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, it wasn't a story I was focusing on.
In Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Rajiv talks a lot about how everybody was screwing everybody else. And you kind of talk about what was going on with the reporters. Was it all heterosexual?
That's an interesting question. I don't remember, actually. I'm just trying to think. That's why I'm silent.
Right.
I didn't spend that much time in the green zone because photographers didn't really have any reason to go there. All the journalists had to go to get interviews with high-level people. But I didn't spend that much time in the green zone because it was much more fun in Baghdad. Homosexual versus hetero, I don't know. I actually just don't know. If I wanted to find out, I'm sure I could have, but I actually was kind of busy sorting out my own personal life. So,
one of your colleagues, Elizabeth Rubin, was pregnant, and not only pregnant, but showing during the most difficult periods. Was her pregnancy normal? Is the kid normal?
Yes, she has a beautiful daughter, and the pregnancy was normal.
So you can actually do more than the doctors tell you you can do.
Well, I mean, no one is going to, you know, and I then got pregnant and went to Somalia and went to Kenya and Afghanistan and Senegal and all of these places. I did not do military embeds while I was pregnant, but I did travel extensively. And no, my OBGYN did not say, don't go to Somalia, but she did say, if you're going to a place where there's malaria, you might want to reconsider that. So, you know, there are pregnant women living and giving birth in these countries every day. So one thing that people have to remember is that actually there is an entire society of women living in these countries. So, I mean, I'm not sure why a girl from Connecticut can't go, but, you know.
Lindsay Addario, let's talk a little about your political views and how they've changed, if they've changed. How do you view at this point in 2015 American interests or invasion or occupation of, say, Afghanistan?
I became very disillusioned after September 11th because I felt like I witnessed a lot of things that could have been prevented. And with simple education and simple training on cultural sensitivity and how to move around and maneuver in the Middle East and a little more engagement rather than sort of just busting into people's homes might have been more effective. And what happened in Abu Ghraib, obviously, that was incredibly damning to our reputation in the Middle East and around the world. And the torture, you know, the fact that we were torturing, it's, you know, the things that we need to own up to. And it's something that I have a very hard time sort of processing how I feel because I've witnessed a lot of things. And, you know, I used to be so proud to go around and say, I'm American. And now I never admit to being American because I can get kidnapped or killed. So generally when I'm overseas, I don't tell anyone where I'm from. And I tell my translators, please don't say I'm American, you know. So what does that say for how far we've come as a nation? I mean, that's a tragedy, really.
The other day I watched The Monuments Men, where at the end of World War II, they sent people out to preserve and take back art. And I compare that to Rumsfeld not giving a damn about the Baghdad Museum.
Yeah, I mean, that was being looted in front of everyone's eyes and no one did anything. And why?
There was no plan, and if there was a plan, as Rajiv said, it concerned trying to create a petri dish for unbridled capitalism in Iraq. It's
yeah.
just nuts.
Yeah, I know.
Israel and Gaza. Do you see anything different than what I'm seeing?
I think there's a lot of coverage. I mean, I think that Gaza is one of the places where for a journalist and a photographer, you can work. And Gazans are very, very savvy about how to use media to get the word out of how they're suffering and what's happening there. So Israel-Gaza, it's pretty transparent. It's pretty clear on both sides what's happening there.
The rise of ISIS, or whatever it's called, mm-hmm. ISIL, it seems to me that that's the ultimate tragedy, or one of the tragedies, of the Iraq invasion.
I fully agree. I think that ISIL has really brought, or ISIS has really brought a whole new dynamic to not only the war, but covering the war, and for journalists on how to actually cover what's happening in Syria and Iraq in a way in which we can stay alive and we won't get kidnapped. And, you know, we've seen with James Foley, Stephen Sotloff, and now Kayla, you know, we don't know what happened to Kayla, you know, and I would not take what ISIS says at face value. So we don't know, but I think the fact that they are beheading and disseminating videos of journalists losing their lives is sick and it's disgusting. And, you know, journalism is a profession that we all rely on. Everyone relies on, whether or not they admit it. We all get our news from journalists and we are aware of what happens around the world from journalists. And so people need to respect that. If we're at the point where journalists, the most seasoned journalists in the world, can't go to Syria because they say, forget it, it's just not worth it, that is a real tragedy for the people of Syria, too, because they're dying and civilians are dying and no one is there to bear witness.
Have you ever seen a TV show called Homeland?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have. I actually love Homeland.
What relationship does that have to reality?
Well, it's fun for me to watch. Some things are very unrealistic and some things are, you know.
Actually, the fact that Carrie walks around in, like, skin-tight pants and her, like, a very loose headscarf in the middle of Pakistan, I don't know if I would do that. There is a lot that's unrealistic, but I do like to watch it as sort of fantasy reality.
What about something that isn't so much fantasy? Can you put your finger on anything?
Not much.
Really?
There's not much out there.
Lindsay Addario, when you were writing about the hostage takeover in Libya, how difficult was it for you to relive that experience?
It was pretty difficult. I try and talk about what happened in Libya openly, and people ask me about it quite often. And so I always talk about it very openly because I believe it's also part of dealing with the trauma of what happened. But going back and sitting in a room alone and writing detail, and I really wanted to write all the details I could from my perspective, it was difficult, especially when I was reliving moments of, I had to watch a video of my husband going on CNN and saying, and he didn't know if I was alive at that point. And Ali Velshi, who was then with CNN, who's now with Al Jazeera, was interviewing him. And Ali said something to the effect of, well, you know, if you could speak to your wife or if she's still alive, what would you say? And he said, and he was visibly shaken in the interview. And he said, you know, come home so we could start a family. And obviously, I would have killed him at the time for publicly basically saying, come get pregnant. But it was very difficult for me to watch because I could see what I had put him through.
You saw some of that when you were still captive, and he doesn't know if you're alive, and you're watching him.
Well, no, I didn't see that till after I got out.
Oh, you didn't?
Yeah,
okay.
I didn't see that till after I got
out. So you didn't see that on the television set, which they eventually took away?
Right, I only saw R4 pictures on the TV set that said, the New York Times, or no, the Libyan government cannot ascertain the whereabouts of these four journalists.
And you're watching a picture of yourself.
Yes.
What was going on through your mind at that point?
Well, I just started crying really hard and saying, don't you have families? I mean, you can keep us captive as long as you want, but let us at least make a phone call and call our families.
Perhaps putting aside all of the horror of what you had to deal with, one of the things that disturbed me in reading the book was the story of Khalid and his shrapnel wounds in the Korengal Valley, which was censored by the Times.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very in-depth story and it's nuanced. So I wanted to write about it because there are many layers and it also touches on the editing process and fact-checking. And so in the fall of 2007, I was with Elizabeth Rubin, and we wanted to do an embed on civilian casualties and why there were so many civilian casualties in Afghanistan and why we as a nation couldn't win the war in Afghanistan if we had the best technology. And so in order to do that, we decided to go directly into the heart of the war and into arguably one of the most dangerous places in Afghanistan at the time, which was the Korengal Valley. And we started our journey at the Tactical Operations Center. So it was like the command center for the Korengal. And that night we were watching a battle unfold, and it was troops in combat, and they were being pinned down by the Taliban. And we were watching drone feeds, heat-sensored screens, all sorts of technology in this command center that I could not photograph because of intelligence reasons. And so I was sort of watching, and the commander decided to drop bombs on the Taliban. And so we watched that, and the next day we were flown directly to that area. And that morning, a family, the men of a family, brought two young boys in, and Khalid was one of them. And his face was smattered with scratches, and his eyes were glassy. And the family said, we were close by to where the bombs fell, and these kids were wounded, and so can you treat them? So, of course, right away, the scene is ironic because they are injured in American bombs, or they say they were, and they go to the American base for treatment from the medics. So while I was photographing Khalid, I did a series of portraits of him, just of his face, the stark portrait. I asked the medic what he thought, and I said, do you think that they were injured? And he said, these wounds are not consistent with a bomb. And of course, he's going to say what the military says. And so
I, as a journalist, wrote that, transcribed that in my caption with the intention of going back and saying, you know, fleshing it out and saying, look, this family said this, we were in the control room, et cetera, et cetera. But we ended up spending 2 months in the Corngal Valley, something that we never anticipated doing. We thought we would do maybe a 10-day, two-week embed because that's generally what the military offered. And so it so happened that the command let us stay as long as we wanted. And at the end of that embed, we went on a battalion-wide operation called Operation Rock Avalanche, and it was very dramatic, and we were ambushed. And so when it came time to file the pictures, months later, the story was running, I think in February it was closing, and we had started in October or September we started. So it was months later. And the New York Times was considering running that photo as a cover. And I got a series of frantic phone calls, and I was in Sudan about to go into Darfur. And they said, well, your caption says this, but you're saying something else happened. And I said, no, this is the whole situation. I explained what happened. And they said, well, the editor-in-chief is hearing from the military that absolutely is there no way to confirm that that boy was injured in a U.S. bomb, which, of course, is what the military is going to say because they don't want to be responsible for civilian casualties. So I got very angry and said, you know, how dare you not take my word and how dare you not listen to my story? I realize I wrote something in the caption, but I'm telling you what happened. And eventually the story ended up shifting to be focused on one of the Captain Kearney. But the editor-in-chief was so angry about the controversy over the photo that he said, we will never run this picture in the magazine. Forget it. It's not even running in a slideshow. This picture won't see the light of day. And so I was furious, and I wrote him a letter, which is a real risk for a freelance photographer at the New York Times Magazine to write a letter to the editor-in-chief. But I asked permission from my photo editor, and I received help writing the letter from my colleague, and I wrote it and sent it. The editor-in-chief was so angry about the whole situation and a series of things, that the story took a long time to run, that a similar story had run in Vanity Fair by Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington. And so after that letter, he said, okay, we'll put a slideshow up, but we will not run Hollett's picture.
And that picture appears.
It appears in the book, and I think I did an interview. I think it was on NewsHour. I don't remember who it was for, and I sent them that picture to run on a TV interview after.
At the beginning of your explanation, you made the comment about winning the war in Afghanistan. One thing I never got, what does it mean to win the war in a place where you're never going to stay? I mean, what does it mean?
It doesn't mean anything. There's no way anyone's going to win a war in Afghanistan because if, you know, some educated Afghans in Kabul who appreciate the stability in Kabul and the education and the some gains that they appreciate, they do not want us to leave. But in the villages and in so much of Afghanistan and the remote areas, they don't want us there. So how can you win a war in a place where so much of the population doesn't want you there?
Have you ever thought about doing video?
Yes, I have shot some video. I actually would love to learn, and I would love to take a class. I've done, I think, 3 or 4 stories where I attempted to do some video, and I never have, like, one comprehensive video that I think is successful because I'm always trying to shoot stills and video. But I would like to learn, and I would like to do more of it because I think that for a photographer who is doing this work, it's important to have all the skills, and then I can figure out how to use them.
Well, since your son was born, this book takes us up to a couple of years ago. Where have you been since?
Last year, in 2014, I was in Afghanistan several times, Iraq. I was in northern Iraq, and I was in Najaf in southern Iraq. I was in South Sudan. I did a big story on migrants turning up on the coast of Sicily. African and Middle Eastern migrants trying to make their way to Europe. So sort of all over.
You put yourself in a lot of danger. I mean, do you, at this point, if someone says, listen, let's take this beaten down, broken car and go to Kandahar, what would you say?
Yeah, no. Now I ask a lot of questions before I get in that car, and I drill the translator and the driver and the correspondent and where exactly is ISIS and where is the front line and how far are we and how do we know that this road is safe. And so I don't just take gratuitous risks because I want to work in a war zone. I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years, covering conflict for 15 years, and I think it's important for anyone who covers conflict to do their homework and to make sure that any risk is a calculated one.
How many languages do you speak now?
I speak Spanish, Italian, English, and I understand a bit of Arabic.
So you can get around a little bit in those places?
A little bit, not very much. I would love to learn Arabic.
And you always have a mind or somebody local to keep you on the right track.
Correct. I always travel with a fixer or a translator.
Lindsay Adario, what do you see in your future going back to any of these places?
I will be in Saudi Arabia and then South Sudan soon. I've been going to Afghanistan for 15 years, so I don't think I'll be stopping anytime soon.
Are your photographs going to be shown anywhere?
I have an exhibition right now at the Nobel Peace Center in Oslo.
And what about a book of photographs?
Oh, that's a great idea. I think I will try to do a book of photos soon.
You've been listening to an interview with Lindsay Adario, whose memoir is titled It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, and it includes several photographs that she's taken over the past, I guess, 15 years.
20 almost.
I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.